It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Former President Donald Trump is at the center of criminal investigations at the state and federal level into his business dealings and political actions. And the U.S. Supreme Court is weighing a Colorado case over whether Trump should be ineligible to be on the ballot due to his role leading up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. So we examine the legal landscape of a former president and hear from you. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Schabo is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. Christine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments over Colorado removing former President Trump from election ballots over his involvement in the Jan 6 attacks on the U.S. Capitol. Why do Colorado's lawyers say Trump should be disqualified from the ballot?
Yes, they say he should be disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which basically is a ban on particular officers or officials of the United States government who have previously taken an oath to support the Constitution and yet participated either in an insurrection or have given comfort or aid to enemies of the United States. So they say that that prohibition fits former President Trump and the actions that he took on January 6th.
And so a bit of history here, because the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment traces back after the Civil War. Can you explain that history and how it's been perhaps applied, in the past?
Certainly. And it does have a history that is rooted in the Civil War and fear people who were once, part of the Confederate States and leaders and fighting against the United States would then become part of the United States government once again, that they would be elected in the Southern states and then become part of the federal government. So the idea was to have a ban on that type of office holding for people who had engaged in insurrection. And one of the things that's, interesting here is that the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is grounded in that history, but it hasn't been applied in more recent years. So I think there's an open question as to how it might apply to former President Trump now, but there are certainly strong legal arguments to say that he still should be disqualified under current understandings of that law.
Yes, I mean, with your legal analysis, does the 14th Amendment apply to Trump?
Sure. And there are a couple of different questions that are up in the air for whether the 14th Amendment does apply. So, first and foremost, there's the question of the merits of whether or not he actually engaged in insurrection. And I think that is an argument or an area where there are strong arguments on both sides. On one hand, his acts on January 6th certainly seemed to encourage a mob to descend on and breach the Capitol. On the other hand, he didn't actually go to the Capitol himself. So I think there might be some questions as to the intersection between acts of insurrection and whether what he did was covered by the First Amendment. So that's really the merits. And interestingly, that is something that the Supreme Court shied away from at oral argument. It seemed to look instead for other procedural grounds under which Section 3 of the 14th Amendment might not apply to Trump.
Why do Trump's legal team say that the former president should be allowed to be on the ballot?
Sure. First of all, say that he did not engage in insurrection. And in addition, they've raised a number of arguments to say that, first of all, Colorado does not have power to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. They argue that it's not a self-executing amendment and that Congress would need to pass enabling legislation before it could be enforced against President Trump. Another argument they have raised is that the president actually is, or presidency, sorry, is not an office that could be disqualifying for purposes of the 14th Amendment. So under the 14th Amendment, there are bans on future office holding by people who have in the past held certain offices that would require them to take an oath to support the U.S. Constitution, and that ban of prohibition applies to people who have taken an oath as officers of the United States, but it doesn't talk about the president of the United States being one of those officers. So there's an open question as to whether the president of the United States is someone who could be subject to Section 3's disqualification. And that's another one of the arguments that Trump's defenders have raised in his case before the Supreme Court.
Christine Chabot with us, associate professor at Marquette University Law School, as we talk about the constitutional questions that come up by lawsuits involving former President Donald Trump. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned, Christine, that the justices in oral arguments were focusing more on procedural explorations. What is your gauge of how the justices responded to the arguments?
After argument, it seemed pretty clear that Trump would probably win either 8-1 or 9-0, that the justices were just looking for some way to reverse the Colorado Supreme Court. And I think this goes not just to the legal merits of the case, but I think here the justices are worried about the consequences of a ruling that would remove Trump from the ballot in Colorado. They are afraid that a decision to remove him from the ballot in Colorado might lead that to happen in other states and have the effect of the Supreme Court deciding the presidential election. And that's something I think they're very reluctant to do in light of what happened several years ago now in Bush versus Gore.
I think it was Justice Brett Kavanaugh who asked the question to Colorado, what about the idea that we should think about democracy and kind of raising concerns about the disenfranchising voters? Is that a tension point here?
It is. And I think the idea is whether the court should take away voters' opportunity to vote for Trump by allowing Colorado to remove him from the ballot. Now, technically, I think there may still be options for write-ins and that sort of thing, but still taking him off the ballot in Colorado could really undermine his presidential campaign and the ability of voters to choose the person that they would like to vote for as the next president of the United States. So that's certainly something that is weighing on the court and the reason why they don't want to be the ones necessarily to decide the outcome of the presidential election. One of the problems, though, is, you know, depending on how the Supreme Court resolves this case, and this is an argument that's been raised in some of the amicus briefs, is it's possible that if the Supreme Court doesn't resolve this issue now at the primary stage, one thing that could happen is we could have in the general election, Trump could win a majority of the Electoral College, and the issue might come up again when it's time for Congress to certify votes under the 12th Amendment. And there could be still, I think, a further constitutional crisis at that point of how to handle that situation. And there might be a scenario where either Congress or potentially the Supreme Court would be asked to take the presidency away from Trump, essentially, after a majority of the Electoral College had indicated that he should be president. And that might be even more of a problem to interfere at that later point in the process than it is to interfere right now.
Do you fear the creation of that type of storm, a constitutional crisis, where in the certification of the election, you know, that it doesn't go the way it is supposed to go? I mean, how definitive could the U.S. Supreme Court's decision be here?
And this really depends, I think, on the route that the court takes to reverse the Colorado Supreme Court. So, for instance, if the Supreme Court, you know, simply said that Colorado as a state does not have authority to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that would still leave open the possibility of enforcement at the federal level and possibly, again, by Congress when it is time to certify electoral votes. So that would be kind of kicking the can down the road in a way that might not avoid crisis in the future. There might be other grounds that the Supreme Court could use, and I'm sure they're thinking carefully about those grounds as a way to potentially resolve this case for good now. One of the grounds that I mentioned earlier, whether the presidency is an office that can subject someone to disqualification for participating in insurrection, that might be an easier way for the court to resolve this dispute. Just say, whatever President Trump did or Trump did when he was president, that isn't something that can disqualify him from holding office again under the 14th Amendment, so that the disqualification just would not apply to Trump. The problem, I think, with that argument is if you think carefully through the history and text of the Constitution, I think that argument is a hypertextual read of the Constitution. If you say that an officer of the United States who has taken an oath to support the Constitution and participates in insurrection is then banned from future office holding, it doesn't make a lot of sense to say that the most powerful officer of the United States, the president, is not included in that particular concept. So I think that is a route the court might try to go to have some certainty, but it is not a legal ruling that I think will be reviewed well in the court of history.
Christine Chabot is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. As former President Donald Trump campaigns for the White House, we discuss the constitutional questions that surface from his appeals in courtrooms. And you can call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As former President Donald Trump vies to reclaim the White House, we examine criminal indictments and the extent of his legal jeopardy with a constitutional law scholar. You can be part of the discussion. You can call in with a question, share your perspective. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Chabot is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. Christine, the former president has a complicated legal picture, facing criminal charges in four cases. And in one of the cases, Trump is charged in federal court with seeking to overturn his 2020 election defeat. And Trump attempted to block the charges by claiming immunity. Can you explain what arguments were made by Trump's lawyers to justify those claims of immunity?
Yes, and the immunity arguments are now actually the subject of another case that is currently before the Supreme Court. There was an emergency application for a stay of the current ongoing criminal proceedings after the Intermediate Court of Appeals, the District of D.C., found that he had no valid claim for immunity. So essentially, Trump is arguing that as a former president, he is entitled to immunity from criminal liability for acts taken that were official acts at the outer bounds of his responsibilities as president of the United States. And that was pretty soundly rejected by the DC Circuit. I think it will also be ultimately rejected by the Supreme Court. And I think the reason it is rejected is because his claim for immunity is weak for several reasons. So, first of all, the strongest claim for immunity would apply to a sitting president, that if you subject a sitting president to criminal process, that will interfere with that person's ability to carry out their duties of office. But as the DC Circuit noted in its opinion denying Trump immunity, there's a distinction between the office of the president and citizen Trump, who is now a former president. So that concern wouldn't apply to pursuing a criminal prosecution against him. The second argument he has is that he should still be entitled to immunity for official acts that he took while in office. But I think here the problem with this particular case is that those official acts were related to interference with the results of the 2020 election. And it wasn't really just focused on the events of January 6th. In this case, the prosecution looks far earlier to, constant challenges to the results of the election in contested states, Wisconsin and other contested states, that went beyond legitimate legal challenges in court to whether certain votes were valid or not, and that Trump conspired with a number of lawyers to use illegitimate means to try and contest the result of elections. For example, it was alleged that he came up with slates of fake electors and tried to have Congress, when it ultimately certified votes on January 6th, accept those fake electors rather than the ones that were officially certified by particular states, Wisconsin and others, in which results had been certified for a Democratic slate of electors instead. So those arguments about him exercising an official role don't really hold up so well, essentially, because there's not an official role for the president in that part of the process of being elected president. Being elected president is up to states, who get to choose their electors by popular votes. And then the final determination of who is president is, under the 12th Amendment, up to Congress to certify and count the votes and see which president had the greatest number of electors. So there's not really an official role for the president in that process. So his claim that he's entitled to immunity for acts taken to try and tamper with that process, I think, doesn't hold up well here. And, I would add, in addition, that you're trying to draw some lines between when is a president entitled to immunity for acts taken in office and when does he cross a line. Mm-hmm. There have been other presidents in the past who have crossed that line, who have engaged in criminal conduct, such as President Nixon. Mm-hmm. And there's understanding under the Constitution that presidents can be subject to criminal acts that they undertake in office. Indeed, that is probably the reason that President Ford later pardoned Nixon, was the understanding that he too could be subject to criminal liability when he crossed the line and violated criminal laws while in office.
Christine Schaba with us, Associate Professor at Marquette University Law School, as we discuss questions, legal questions being raised by the cases involving former President Donald Trump. Call in with questions. Share your comments. 800-642-1234. So, Christine, we're seeing some of the upcoming trial dates popping up here on the dockets. And I'm just wondering, if there is a conviction at a trial, I mean, is that new territory for the U.S.? What should we know about such consequences?
It is new territory, and I think part of it will depend on which criminal case goes first and which one there might be a conviction. And there could be a big difference in the consequences, first of all, just depending on whether the conviction is based on federal law, as the case in the D.C. Circuit they were just discussing, or whether it is one of two cases that are based on state law. Mm-hmm. And if there is a criminal conviction based on state law, those cases are pending right now in New York and Georgia, President Trump, even if you're or current former President Trump, if he were elected as president again, couldn't pardon himself for those state criminal convictions. So he would be subject to the consequences of those state criminal convictions. There's some question if he were convicted for federal crimes and then still became president, if he would be able to pardon himself potentially and therefore lift the sentence or consequence of being convicted for federal crimes. But it is uncharted territory. We don't know exactly how that would play out. I think one of the reasons that Trump's big defense in many of these cases is delay is that it would be much easier for him if the criminal cases were not completed by the time he were potentially elected president. Then he would have a further argument for immunity, that the criminal cases should not be ongoing while he was in office. So I think that's why he's raising a bunch of arguments to try and drag out the proceedings. For example, the federal case about tampering with the election was originally scheduled for trial on March 4th. That is not going to happen now that Trump has raised on appeal arguments that he should just be immune from criminal suit. And while those immunity arguments were ultimately not meritorious ones, they did serve the purpose of
slowing
dragging
down
out the clock and making the process take longer. So I think that is going to be his strategy here, is to try to make all of these criminal cases take as long as possible in order to make sure that there is no conviction before the November elections.
Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Christine Schabo is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.